This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, some Native Americans say Facebook is discriminating against them. We'll talk to a leader in the Native American community about the problem and what Facebook is doing about it.
First, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office released numbers yesterday that show a 72% spike in heroin deaths in Milwaukee last year. This was the highest number of drug-related deaths ever recorded by the agency.
To put that in perspective, last year, 74 in that area died in vehicle crashes, and heroin-related deaths topped out at 119.
And Milwaukee's not alone. Yesterday in Madison, lawmakers, doctors, and law enforcement officials gathered to try to come to grips with the rising problem of heroin around the state.
With us now is Dr. Ian Powell. He's an addiction specialist with Rogers Memorial Hospital. He oversees and treats patients in an outpatient setting in the Milwaukee area. Dr. Powell, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Well, we've seen this jump in heroin in Wisconsin, these deaths in Milwaukee. Is this something you see reflected in your practice, more people showing up with signs of opioid addictions?
Yes, most certainly. We've had many patients come to us with problems from chemical use. Alcohol is an endemic problem in Wisconsin. And then historically, it would be a vast majority of patients would be coming to us with alcohol problems. But that has been surpassed in the last several years by patients with opiate addiction, specifically heroin, specifically young people who are coming to us with already several years of heroin use, with the typical route of administration being injection, which is causing the lethality, but it's causing the jump in overdose deaths.
So it's a huge question, I know, but what do you see as the root of this big increase in heroin use and heroin-related deaths?
Probably the availability of heroin, its cost. The report I'm getting from individual patients is that it's relatively inexpensive. That can be compared to the cost of diverted pharmaceutical-grade opiates, which was a problem more in the last 5 or 10 years, though we've seen that problem subside with opiates such as OxyContin, Vicodin, oxycodone, where patients were misusing those opiates, now switching to heroin. Probably the availability of those types of opiates has diminished, and as a result, people are looking elsewhere for opiates, and heroin is available and cheap. There may also be perceptions that heroin is not as dangerous as it used to be, and thus people who might have been dissuaded from using it because they thought it wasn't particularly addicting or dangerous, maybe using it as a result. However, given the type of information that the public can see through these types of reports, I would imagine that the perception that heroin is dangerous, if not deadly, is probably changing.
Now, is it more common now that heroin is the first opiate that people are trying, or is it still the story that a lot of people were getting addicted to prescription opiates, whether prescribed to them or obtained in some other way, and then moved to heroin?
We get both stories. We still have patients who are introduced to opiates either through prescriptions that they got themselves or from diverting opiates to the bottle of Vicodin that's left over in the medicine cabinet from a household member's, you know, past dental procedure or surgery and using those for themselves, or obtaining opiates from their peers who are sharing them. But yes, you're right. Those stories are becoming less frequent, and now we're seeing people move straight to heroin who don't have a history or a story where they've been using pharmaceutical-grade opiates like Vicodin or OxyContin prior to using heroin.
Well, these numbers that we mentioned earlier from Milwaukee made big headlines, and I think heroin is stereotypically viewed as an urban problem. Is that, if that ever was true, is it true now?
Certainly not. Though the majority of patients that I treat in the Milwaukee area are coming from the metropolitan area, I have practiced in other areas in Wisconsin where I was treating patients who were coming from predominantly rural areas, and we were seeing significant problems from heroin. In addition, talking to colleagues in the field, it doesn't seem to matter where the patients are living. People seem to be able to find heroin in their own areas, and that can be rural areas. And it may be that there are trafficking networks available in these rural areas where people can make their purchases locally as opposed to traveling to metropolitan areas.
Now, when people show up for treatment, come to you for treatment, are they there voluntarily, they realize they have a problem, they need treatment? Are they there because law enforcement sent them there, or some combination?
Almost anyone who enters treatment for a chemical problem, including heroin, is coming into treatment because there's some sort of external pressure to make some changes. A lot of times it's law enforcement entanglements. Often it's at the request of an employer. In fact, your employer has the most leverage with someone with a chemical use problem to help that person enter treatment. Other issues that may come up is family are requesting that the person make changes, or health concerns, financial concerns. There can be many, but almost everyone is under some sort of external pressure. Obviously, the legal system, if one does not comply with what has been stipulated, if there are charges pending or perhaps deferred if the patient enters drug treatment, can be a strong motivator for someone to come in and get help.
I want to talk about solutions and what can be done to address this. First of all, at the individual level, someone addicted to heroin, what kind of treatments are there, and how effective are they?
Treatment for substance use works. We have similar rates of success for treating the disease of addiction as you see in other chronic diseases, such as coronary artery disease that causes heart attacks, or diabetes that causes blood sugar elevation that can cause a lot of organ damage. Usually our rates of success are around about 40%. And certainly the patient needs access to treatment that they can get into fairly quickly without delayed waits. Unfortunately, due to the magnitude of the problem, many clinics or hospitals that do treat patients for addiction, specifically opiate addiction, do have substantial wait times right now, which can be a barrier to getting help. When patients do enter treatment, they may need detoxification first. They need access to counseling. Sometimes counseling that can be fairly intense, where patients come several hours, several times a week. Sometimes they need to be in residential care where they reside at a facility. Now, the other important aspect is to combine counseling with medications that can help patients stay clean. These are medications such as methadone maintenance, use of a medication called buprenorphine, more commonly known as Suboxone, as well as another medication called naltrexone, which is an injection, which has the trade name Vivitrol, which can be injected into the patient's muscle and released over time, over a 30-day period. All three medications can work well. They all have their risks and benefits, but when combined with counseling and improvement in one's recovery environment, as to staying away from using peers, results can be quite good sometimes.
On the policy level, mentioned that there was a meeting of lawmakers, health professionals, law enforcement yesterday. The last session of the legislature saw a package of new laws related to heroin, moving away from punishment, trying, I think, to get more toward treatment. Do you think that Wisconsin is moving the right direction when it comes to heroin policies?
I believe so. I think some of the bills that have gone through the state legislature recently have been very helpful. Specifically, making a reversal agent that can save someone's life in the moment, called Narcan, also called Naloxone, more available to first responders, not just paramedics who are the most highly trained life support technicians, but all levels of life technicians, such as ambulance drivers, as well as law enforcement, fire department personnel, will help save lives in the moment, and also making it so that families can have prescriptions for Narcan in the household if they need to use it on a member of the household who has a problem with opiate addiction. Overall, though, this is a disease. It's not a crime to have the disease of addiction. And certainly, if we can divert patients into treatment where they have a possibility of treating that disease and allowing it go into remission, this is much better option for individuals than to be incarcerated in our jails, in our prisons, where access to treatment is minimal and relapse rates are fairly high on individuals released from jails and prisons, even if they're in for periods of time, such as several weeks, months, or years.
Now, given the numbers we're seeing in Milwaukee, around the state, there's a good chance someone listening is dealing with this issue right now, maybe in their family. What advice would you give to a person or the family of someone who is facing heroin addiction right now?
Well, certainly you don't want to enable someone's addiction, and that is to say to interfere with the consequences of that person's use by bailing them out of trouble, allowing the disease to continue. And this could be providing them with money or using one's influence to prevent them from having entanglements with the law enforcement system, because if they do run into trouble with law enforcement, there's a good chance that they may end up entering treatment by being in deferred prosecution or going through a drug court as opposed to incarceration. But certainly families need to know what the resources are to get help and should have that type of information researched so that they can provide the individual who's affected with the phone numbers that they need so they can call for that help.
Dr. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Ian Powell. He's an addiction specialist with Rogers Memorial Hospital, talking about recent news on rising heroin deaths in Wisconsin.
First, we're talking about how some Native Americans say Facebook is biased against them. It has to do with the social media site's name policy.
Arvina Martin joins us now. She's the chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. She's a member of the Ho-Chunk and Stockbridge Munsee tribes. Arvina, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So why are some Native Americans saying that Facebook is discriminating against them?
Well, we've been finding that a lot of names have been reported to Facebook as fake. They're being reported by other users, not necessarily flagged by specific software that Facebook has. And then their accounts are being locked out because their names do not kind of conform to a standard format that, you know, many other Americans do.
And it sounds like Facebook has a policy where it has been trying to root out profiles attached to fake names, and a lot of Native American names, it sounds like, are getting flagged under that policy.
Yes, yes. And when they're being flagged, their profiles are basically shut down, often without notice, and then they have to go through the whole rigmarole in order to get their accounts back and access.
And just to be clear, what kind of names, Native American names, are we talking about here?
They're kind of traditional kind of names that are maybe Anglo or Anglicized. Things like Brown Eyes. A lot of the times the people's names have spaces in them when there's more than one actual word in them. For example, Her Many Horses or names like that.
And in terms of the rigmarole to get as you put it, your Facebook account back online again, what has to happen to do that? What do you have to do?
There seems to be a whole process where you have to prove your identity and prove that that's your name, whether it is taking a picture of your driver's license or a library card or mail and sending that to the Facebook administrators. But it doesn't seem to always be just that. There are stories of people having to send pictures of credit cards that they don't want. So obviously they don't want to do that. And then they have to either restart a new Facebook profile with a name that conforms to the standards, or they're just out of luck.
So it sounds like there's not one standardized route to getting the Facebook profile put back up. It sounds like lots of different things can happen, but it involves social security cards, credit cards, and lots of different things sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't seem to be uniform.
So from, I guess, the Facebook perspective, they're seeing names that look to them, unless they look closely enough, like made-up names that fit what they're calling fake name profiles. What message does that send, though, when those names start getting locked out to Native Americans? Why are people worried about this?
Because it is just another example of how U.S. culture at large doesn't see our identity the same way that we do. Our names are our names, and we feel very strongly about them, as everybody feels strongly about their names. And it's, again, another opportunity for culture at large to tell us that we don't conform and we're not the same, and our identities are not as how we perceive them ourselves.
Well, Facebook has been made aware of this issue. What has Facebook had to say about it?
Not much, just that they're continuing to look into things and they want to work with people who have been locked out. But I know that a lot of people that have been locked out are still very, very frustrated with the process, especially those who have profiles that they've had for many years. It's got all their pictures, any posts that they've made. We're finding a lot of people that do social activism are being targeted in this way and having their accounts locked out.
Why would that be?
People that are very active on social media in terms of various issues, people that are anti the Washington Redskins name, for example, or there was an event in the Dakotas earlier where some students were kind of, they were attacked and had beer thrown at them at a hockey game. And there have been a lot of activists talking about that racial kind of hate crime, if you will, experience that they had.
Oh, so they might be out there and maybe more likely than to have another user flag them, maybe maliciously,
exactly,
and bring that to Facebook's attention.
Yes, yes.
Do you know anyone personally who's had this happen and has gone through the procedure?
The people that I know personally that have had it happen to them kind of had it happen years ago, but there are a lot of people in various Facebook groups that I'm a part of who have had this happen, and they talk about how, you know, they have to take weeks out in order to get their access back. And of course, we don't know what happened. You know, if there's people that we are working with through social media, you know, we don't know why they're gone.
It occurs to me this maybe isn't a thing that would be original for Facebook. So many forms in American culture have one space for a last name. If you've got a last name with multiple words with spaces, is this something that's come up even in the pre-social media era?
Yeah, it has. You know, a lot of government forms and other forms don't like names with multiple words in them or with spaces.
Well, it's an interesting issue because America is, of course, a diverse place. And I know that Facebook went through something similar with drag queens earlier, and they had names that were flagged as fake. And it sounds like were somewhat organized, got in there, and now Facebook has apologized and tried to restore those pages. Do you see that this issue with Native American names following a similar route?
I hope so. I really do. Unfortunately, I think that we're such a small part of the population. There's so few of us. You know, when you think about how many users are on Facebook all over the world. And, you know, hopefully the more we talk about this, the more Facebook will be willing to listen to Native people and fix things.
So what kinds of activism are out there to try to put the heat, I guess, on Facebook?
There are people talking to the media. There have been reports in the Washington Post, on ABC News, about the issue and people getting locked out of their accounts and flagged. Things like this, like you guys having me here today. And we're just trying to get things out through various forms of media, whether it is traditional media or social media.
Now, reading some about this, some of the people nationally who've had this kind of issue, there was a man named, I think it was Henry Standing Bear, or that was Creeping Bear, I believe was his last name. He got a personal apology from someone at Facebook, and he wasn't satisfied with that. So given that there's some apologies going on and Facebook has said that they're aware of it, what would you like to see them to do to remedy it to your satisfaction?
I think that simple flagging shouldn't be necessarily the way to by users, by other Facebook users. I think that is ripe for abuse, especially when there are so many people using their Facebook and other social media accounts to engage in social activism. It's a really easy way to silence people, and we're seeing that happen quite a bit. So we would like that to kind of calm down a bit. You know, I would really like to see Facebook come up with some ideas as well that haven't come out yet.
So dial down the flagging for now and work on a more permanent solution?
Yeah, yeah.
On a wider note, do you see this potentially, while there are negatives here, potentially being a teachable moment for wider issues of Native American culture within American society?
I hope so. We always want these kind of negative experiences to have a positive impact in the long run. And I think that understanding that we have names that are different than other people's names sometimes, you know, that's a good way to start the understanding.
Have you heard from people outside the Native American community who have, you know, rallied to this cause and said this needs to be fixed, maybe?
A little bit. It's mostly people that are allies to us, to the Native American communities that are already there. So it hasn't gotten a lot of widespread coverage and attention from people that aren't already aware of the issue.
Looking ahead, do you have a timeline in mind how soon you're hoping to see this this problem addressed and resolved?
You know, as long as it gets addressed, I'll be happy with that. I honestly don't have a timeline myself.
And in the meantime, are you still active on Facebook?
Oh, I definitely am. Yeah.
So you wouldn't opt out?
No, no. It's far too valuable a tool for engaging people and getting ideas out there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Arvina Martin, chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about why some Native Americans are protesting Facebook's policy on usernames.
Potential candidates for president are trying to get connected with donors to support them through the primary season, and a new report from a previous campaign may give an indication of the kind of money that could be at play.
Bayfield County passed a one-year moratorium on large-scale farms yesterday evening as an Iowa outfit is looking to build a hog farm there with around 24,000 animals. Supporters say it gives the county more time to study risks and oversight with large farms. Opponents are concerned about how existing farms could be affected. Danielle Kading reports.
Okay, we'll get that.
Officers turned people away as a crowd of around 200 people lined the walls of the Bayfield County boardroom last evening. They spoke for and against the moratorium stemming from Iowa-based Reichsview Farms' plans to build a large-scale hog farm 8 miles from Lake Superior. People who support this moratorium want more time to study the risks of large farms, including things like manure running into the lake. Jim Zorn lives a half mile from where Reichs would build.
We need a surveillance system. We need baseline data. We need to know where that water will go. We need to have our wells tested. We need to have a protocol set up to test not just for sulfates, but for hormones and pharmaceuticals.
Zorn says the issue isn't whether people are for or against farming, but several farmers said they were frustrated over comments from people who have no firsthand experience with farms and how they're regulated. Jessica Pierce raises beef and hogs with her family.
I am most concerned about the impact a moratorium will have on other farms, such as myself. Even if I want to build a new barn to house my cattle.
Mason farmer Clay Burdett says a moratorium sends a message to farmers that the county doesn't want them to succeed.
A farm has to grow and adapt to changing trends and new technologies. That is how we better ourselves and our animals.
The board cut off public comment after an hour. That drew protest from Red Cliff tribal member Gretchen Morris. As officers escorted her from the meeting, Morris says a large-scale farm would threaten their rights to hunt, fish, and gather.
You know, I don't want to have to force you out of here. But
you're violating our treaty rights. Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, 1854 treaty. We will not allow it.
Board members asked their legal counsel about the possibility that Reichs could sue over the moratorium and whether it already has a legal right to build. Bayfield County Corporation Counsel Linda Coleman says that remains unclear.
There's no way anybody could get up here today and tell you they are not vested, absolutely 100%.
Bayfield's attorney Glenn Stoddard spoke on behalf of around 3,000 people who signed a petition supporting a moratorium. Stoddard says it will end up in court either way.
But I'm telling you right now, when you can fill a room like this and you've got tribes and you've got people from a city like Ashland and other people who are concerned about it, you bet there's going to be litigation.
Board members also asked Reichsview Farms representatives about how they run and the risks involved. Reichsview Farms Swine Operations Director Gene Nome says they would be proud to operate in Bayfield County.
We plan to continue to do livestock farming in a same, safe, and professional manner that we do now and that we do in the state of Iowa.
The moratorium passed by the board affects new farms of 1,000 animals or more and existing farms seeking to grow. The moratorium does not apply to farms that have a legal right to build. Bayfield County Board Member Bill Bussey says that distinction gives the county time to find out more.
We're basically deferring our decision on whether Reichs is grandfathered or not.
Reichs Nome declined to comment on the moratorium, saying they'll have to evaluate the decision. A county committee will now form to study the impact large-scale farms have on groundwater, surface water, and air quality. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
Last fall's congressional election is a few months behind us, but when it comes to the money behind the race, the numbers are still coming out. The latest numbers show that it was the most expensive midterm election in history, even though fewer people actually made donations than in previous elections.
Russ Choma joins us now to sort out those spending numbers. He's a money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. The new report on money in that congressional race is online at opensecrets.org. Russ, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the big numbers. How much money went into that congressional race nationwide?
So
So the 2014 midterms, we counted it cost $3.77 billion, which was an all-time high for a midterm election.
And are we talking direct donations to candidates, or does this include outside groups as well?
This includes outside groups, includes money to candidates, includes PACs, super PACs, 527s, and it's spending. So anything that was disclosed as having being spent, we got. So there's a lot of money we don't necessarily know where it came from, but we know it was spent, so we counted that. There is probably $100 to $200 million at least that was spent that was never officially recorded anywhere. So that's not in our calculation because you can't count what hasn't been reported.
Now, what kind of money is out there that isn't disclosed at all that you wouldn't be able to report on?
So, I mean, that's the truly outside, truly dark money. you know, if you make an explicitly political ad, no matter who you are, whether you're a super PAC or a candidate or even one of these politically active nonprofits, which are sort of mysterious as to where they get their money from, if you make one of those explicit ads, you've got to report that it was made and that you spent money airing it. So, but you know, if one of these ads was one of these groups was able to sort of get around some of the rules and some of the language about explicit terms that are used to advocate for or against a candidate, that might not have to be reported.
We'll get a little more into where exactly the money is going. But one of the interesting things here, a record-setting election, as you said, but fewer people are actually donating money. How does that work out?
Right. That's one of probably the most fascinating thing that we found. Every election that we've looked at, and going back to 1990, every election has been more expensive than the one before. Every midterm is more expensive. Every presidential election is more expensive. But every time, there's also been more donors than the one before. This is the first midterm where there have actually been fewer identifiable donors than the election before, even though the total cost went up. And the average donation, or the average amount that an individual donated, went up to an all-time high. Of about $2,600 was the average amount that was donated by someone we could identify.
And that was a fairly substantial jump over the previous average, right?
That's right. In 2010, the average was about $1,900. And we figured we lost about 96,000 donors in between the 2010 and the 2014 election. So about 11% of the donors in 2010, 11% fewer.
So it sounds like a shrinking pool of smaller donors, a growing pool of people who are donating a lot of money. So all these various entities, the candidates, the outside groups in particular, I guess, relying more and more on fewer and fewer big spenders.
That's right. We're saying that there was more money went in and fewer people paid for it.
So how does it break down versus, donating directly to candidate X or the national party or, the congressional group of that party or these outside groups? What are the percentages there?
So the candidate, giving to candidates is still and the parties and sort of like the hard system, hard money system that's, regulated and where everything's disclosed, that's still the bulk of the money. It was about $2.7 billion. About $888 million was spent by House candidates and about $685 million was spent by Senate candidates. And then the parties spent probably about another $1 billion, a little bit more than that. And so, the bulk of the money is still in that system, but it's a smaller piece of the pie than it used to be. We figure outside groups accounted for about 13 or 14% of the spending this time, which doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it's a growing amount. And considering that most of these groups couldn't have existed before 2010, and so this is really only the second midterm that they've been available to people, that's pretty significant that they've already taken that chunk.
And you mentioned things changing over the last handful of years. How much of this do you think comes from the impact of big Supreme Court decisions on campaign contributions, including Citizens United?
I mean, I think it absolutely has a lot to do with that. I mean, like I was saying, a lot of these groups just couldn't have existed. And the amount of spending from super PACs has just really, really exploded. I mean, there were other forms of outside spending before 2010, but the groups that we're seeing spending the most simply didn't exist. And the two largest, the largest individual donor in this last election was a guy named Tom Steyer, who donated about $73 million. And in 2012, it was a guy named Sheldon Adelson who donated about $92 million. You just could not have made those donations prior to Citizens United. So, I mean, that definitely is changing changing the sort of the formula, and you know, guys like that really do change, you know, the average donation that we're seeing people make.
I'm not sure how the timing works out coming into this particular election, but there were also changes, limits lifted on aggregate donations, meaning how much one could donate to all different candidates put together. That that went away at the federal level. Did that have an impact on these midterm elections yet?
I think it did. And so that decision was, it was a Supreme Court decision called McCutcheon versus the FEC, and that was last April. And so it wasn't fully in effect this election cycle, but it definitely will be in the 2016. And it, prior to that, the maximum that an individual could give to candidates and to parties and to PACs was $123,000 every 2 years. And in last April, the Supreme Court did away with that. And so it was a huge boon to you know, the party committees and I think to some of the candidates and some of the PACs, because, you know, previously they could go to a big donor and the donor said, you know, I can't give any more. I've already hit my $123,000 cap. Now the donor doesn't have that excuse anymore, and so they can keep on giving. And so in late December, when the Congress passed the Cromnibus spending bill, they inserted some language in there that made it actually expanded the amount that people can give to party committees. So, you know, before last April, you couldn't give more than $123,000 to all committees and all candidates, and now you can probably give about $1 million in a 2-year cycle to just to the parties alone, and then you can give to as many different candidates or PACs as you can find to give to.
We're talking to Russ Choma with the Center for Responsive Politics about campaign spending in the last year's congressional races. His group's report found that it was the most expensive midterm campaign ever, even though fewer people donated money to campaigns and outside groups than in the past.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think there's too much money in political campaigns? Do you want to see more regulations? Or do you agree with the recent Supreme Court rulings that say campaign spending is a form of protected political expression? Call and join our conversation at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Noah Ovshinsky.
We continue our conversation now about a record-breaking election, last year's race for Congress, the most expensive midterm election ever, according to a new report. Our guest is Russ Choma, money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the influence of money in politics? Do you worry about whether candidates who take donations from groups, from individuals, are beholden to them? Do you support Supreme Court decisions that say, hey, these donations are a form of political expression? They are protected by the First Amendment. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org. Russ, one angle we didn't get into about where this money is going is by party. Democrats, Republicans, how does that break down?
So the way we looked at it was Team Red and Team Blue, because there's a lot of these outside groups which don't necessarily claim a specific party affiliation, but they're clearly conservative or liberal. And so looking at it that way, we figure that Team Red outspent Team Blue, but only by a small fraction. You know, Team Red spent $1.766 billion, and Team Blue spent $1.722 billion. So it's a margin of about $44.4 million. The important thing there, though, is that that is disclosed money. And when you start bringing in that non-disclosed spending that we are pretty sure is out there but can't put an exact number on, but it's probably $100 to $200 million, that probably extends the margin quite a bit, because a lot of that money is on the conservative side of things.
And now, how about how this may be an indicator for the presidential race? Are there signs you're seeing from this report from last year that may be an indication of what we're going to see in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, it's always safe to predict that the next election is going to cost more, and I think the 2016 one is going to be a big one. And I think that, you know, this pattern of fewer donors might continue, simply because there is an ability to raise more money from fewer people. And so, if you're a candidate or if you have a cause, you know, instead of doing a lot of hard work, you know, drumming up grassroots support and collecting lots and lots of $5 or $15 or $20 donations, you know, if you can go out and you can get big checks from a donor who will support your whole slate of candidates, or who will, you know, write a 6 or 7 or 8 figure check to your super PAC, it's a lot easier to go that way.
Talking to Russ Choma about a record-setting year, last year's midterm election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. Richard is with us in Prairie du Chien. Richard, hi.
Hi. I guess the jury's in now that we no longer have a government by the people and for the people. We have a plutocratic government by the rich and for the rich. And you can also see that in that the Democrats and the Republicans didn't really outspend each other. It sounds like the elite are hedging their bets. As I like to say, it's a party, but the people are not invited. So, you know, I personally think voting has become very meaningless because it doesn't seem like who you vote for. The Democrats pander to the working class, but they don't help the working class. At least the Republicans are honest enough to say that we're not going to help you at all. We're going to help the rich. And your guests basically is just, you know, proven that that's true.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Russie brought up a lot there. It goes a bit beyond your study, but is there a sense that all this money coming from fewer people now might be creating some sort of disillusionment with politics, with the election system?
I absolutely think that's true. I mean, this is an issue that no matter what side of the aisle you're on, people have expressed frustration with the amount of money in politics. Republicans are concerned about, some of the big liberal donors, people like Tom Steyer, some of the money coming from unions, and liberals tend to be concerned about, you know, Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and some of the big corporate money. And honestly, you know, both sides are right. There is a lot of money coming from a lot of different places. And I think that really does frustrate people. And it also, I think there's a feeling in politics that a lot of people don't like it. A lot of politicians say, well, I don't like the way things are going, but I'm not going to be the first one to pull back on this. You know, none of them want to be the guy who's fighting with one arm tied behind his back because he refused to take money from some of these big outside groups. And so it sort of creates an arms race situation.
Get back to our callers now. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see less money in politics, new laws, new regulations, or do you think the system's right? Political spending is the equivalent of free speech. Jim is with us next in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call, and I'll take any response off the air, too. I think it's interesting that all the money that's donated to both parties and so forth is tallied up, and, you know, they're extremely large amounts. But that really doesn't tell us very much other than there's irrational amounts of money being put into it. What I'd like to know is there any research and work done on the donors, wherever they're coming from, and the amount of money that they give? What are they getting for it? Because it's not a tax write-off, so I predict there has to be something they're getting for it. Is there a company? Is there a corporation? What do they get out of it? That's what I like to see some research done. And then that's when the voters can start really nailing, the irrational amounts of money that are given.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Russ, is that something that you try to track at the Center for Responsive Politics, whether these donations maybe buy some kind of influence?
Yeah, and that's sort of the age-old question with campaign finances. What are these people giving so much money for? Because, as the caller noted, this is not a tax write-off. This is not a charity. Clearly, they're expecting something from somebody. But if you ask the donors, they say, "Oh no, there's nothing specific we're asking for," and the politicians will deny that they're giving anything. And in a true case of quid pro quo, where here's some money, now do this for me, that's bribery, that's illegal, the FBI will investigate it, and people do from time to time get in trouble for it. We tend to think it's more about access. And when you go down a list of a politician's big donors, it's about who they're spending time with and who they're talking to and who they're looking to for advice and who they consult with. Because the pressure, there's so much pressure on politicians to raise so much money, and they are so reliant on money and on the big checks that they spend a lot of their day raising money. And if you come to them with a big check, you're literally saving them time, and they'll give you that time to talk to you. And so I don't think it's always like a sort of a straight, here's some money, now do as I tell you. But I do think it's about access, and it's about who they're surrounded by and who they're listening to.
We'll go to Carlos in Madison next. Carlos, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
If you look at what is being presented to you, if you look at what you have in front of you, if there's a heck of a lot more money being pumped into politics and less donors, that money's got to be coming from fewer people with a whole bunch of money. And the argument that money or contributions, political contributions, are a form of political free speech in a way, anybody with an ounce of reason can see that they're trying to make money basically be equivalent to a person's voice or a person's opinion.
Gotcha. Carlos, we'll leave it there. Russ, brief thoughts. What are you watching for now as we approach 2016, briefly?
Well, you know, I think we're really trying to scrutinize these outside groups, because I think that is, as we move, you know, where the Iowa caucuses are not actually that far off, and the candidates right now are engaged in the money primary. You know, they're trying to raise as much money as they can, and try not only to prepare themselves, but to convince other candidates that it's not worth running against them. You know, Jeb Bush has said he's got these big goals, and a lot of that is just to keep other people from jumping into the race.
Thanks to Russ Choma, money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. You can see their new report at opensecrets.org.